ahead.
Morning, Your Honor. James Shavoy for Appellants Donald and Janet Metcalf. This is one of three appeals. We submit that this appeal and the appeal that will come after this have one overriding issue that should be kept in mind as the Court determines the merits of both appeals, and that is the recusal motion. There was a recusal motion filed in the bankruptcy court after the second reversal of the bankruptcy court's tentative ruling with respect to two dispositive motions that had been filed in the bankruptcy court.
Wait a second. This particular issue doesn't have anything to do with the recusal motion that you're arguing right now, right?
We're looking at 0555158. Which one are you doing?
Oh, he didn't make that argument.
No, 0555158. That's the one we're arguing.
Okay.
But I would simply ask the panel to keep in mind the recusal issue in the matter following this one. I believe that's important because in this case, the trustee filed the preference action to recover the $20,000 that was paid within 90 days of bankruptcy. We submitted evidence that the payment was not from the debtor, was not part of the debtor's estate, but in fact came from a third party, passed through the debtor, and then was paid to Mr. Metcalf in satisfaction of the judgment. The initial tentative ruling of the bankruptcy court was that a tribal issue of fact existed as to the earmarking of these funds, that they may not have been part of the debtor's estate, and that the matter should submit to trial. After the tentative ruling, there were ex-party contacts.
But that's the other case, right?
That's the other case. But
you're going to argue that case now?
No, but I'm just...
Are you arguing both cases?
I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, why?
Do you want to?
Yeah. Why don't we?
I believe the point that you're making is that somehow infected this ruling too. The problem is that issue isn't presented in this case.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay. So this case has got some wrinkles of its own. So maybe you can explain. Putting aside the tentative ruling, we review final rulings.
Sure.
So looking at the final ruling. Why is it wrong, given the fact that there is nothing to show a direction by Asante, or however it pronounces itself, that these funds go where they went?
Well, we believe at the summary judgment stage there are facts which would raise a reasonable inference that there was, in fact, a direction by Asante that these funds go through ad box directly to Metcalf in order to stave off Metcalf's foreclosure of his security interest in the ad box stock. Ernatoft admits that Wernerdahl came to him and asked him for a loan in order to pay this judgment. He knew that the funds he gave to Ernatoft or to Wernerdahl would be used to pay this judgment. The fact that they went through a series of convoluted transactions before they actually got to Metcalf.
Meant that some of them could have gone to anybody.
Well, that's true. It could have gone to anybody. But at the summary judgment stage, we contend that the undisputed facts that he knew these funds were going to, these funds were requested to pay Metcalf. He knew they were going to pay Metcalf. And the inference.
But, counsel, that's not really the standard, isn't it? Don't you have to show that there was an agreement that the funds must be used to pay your client, the obligation owed to your client, do you not?
Correct.
Where in the record is that shown?
Well, at the summary judgment stage, we believe we have submitted evidence that Ernatoff was aware the loan was needed to pay the debt, that the there was a direct flow of the funds from Ernatoff to Adbox to Metcalf, and that the only reason he gave them to Adbox and Wernerdahl was to pay off the Metcalf judgment.
But there was no evidence. I mean, again, the key here is there had to be an agreement that it must be used for that, and I'm asking you, where in the record does that show? I know there was some supposition and suggestion that that may have been the case, that you said that. I know the other party said the contrary, but in order to establish what you're trying to establish, you have to show the agreement and that it had to be used that way. I don't find anything in the record that shows that. Where am I missing something?
Well, there was no written agreement.
Okay, let's say there's no written agreement. Tell me the oral agreement that everybody agrees upon that said, here's the agreement, and it had to be used, the money had to be used to pay your client. Where is that show on the record?
Well, again, we believe that you have to pull in the different facts we've submitted that we have at this point. Again, we're at the summary judgment stage.
I understand that, but a lot of cases are dismissed at summary judgment level. Each party has certain obligations. In order to succeed at to raise a tribal issue of fact, you have to make a show, a prima facie showing that there was an agreement that the money was going to be put into AdBox to pay your client and that the funds had to be used for that. I don't see that in the record, and I'm asking you, where is it?
Well, Your Honor, if I might, I submit at this point, I think we have to show that there's a tribal issue of fact whether there was.
You have to make a prima facie showing that that would raise a tribal issue of fact, so that if you went back, but
right.
You've got to make a prima facie showing.
I believe we have on the facts I've enunciated. That
let me ask you a question. You say that one of the facts that support, and you want us to have sort of an inference that there was an agreement. But one of the facts is that was to ward off the foreclosure by Metcalf based on the judgment.
Right.
That you only paid him $21,000, and wasn't he also entitled to an additional $600-something in attorney's fees? And couldn't he have nevertheless foreclosed on that basis?
No, because the attorney's fee obligation was a subsequent obligation after the agreement establishing the security agreement. The $20,000 was the tail end of the amount that Werner-Dahl agreed to pay for the business.
Right, and but that was found after it went up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals entered the judgment, which included attorney's fees, right?
But the attorney's fee award was an amount. Well, it wasn't secured by the AdBox stock. There was no agreement by the parties that an award of attorney's fees would be secured by the AdBox stock. The agreement between the parties was that the purchase price of the business, $315,000, of which the $20,000 was the last amount that had to be paid, would be secured by the AdBox stock. If there was litigation arising out of the transaction selling AdBox, the prevailing party would be entitled to attorney's fees, and conceivably he could go after the AdBox stock, but it wouldn't be that obligation wouldn't be secured by the AdBox stock. So in response to your question, we submit that the sequence of events leading up to the payment of the $20,000 by Ernetoff to AdBox, to the lawyers, and eventually to Metcalf raises the inference that there was an agreement because there was...
Raises the inference that there was an agreement, but you have not pled or shown that there was an agreement. As you know, counsel, you got a bankruptcy situation. You're going out of the normal course here. Normally, when something goes into a bankrupt estate, it's subject to the bankruptcy trustee and all the other controls. The only way it gets out where it can flow through directly is if there is an agreement that that's what it's going to do, and it must be used for that. No other way. Inferences don't work. You've got to have an agreement, and I don't see that pled, and I certainly don't see a prima facie case of that. In the record, if you can correct me, I'd love to have you do that so I can get my mind straight on it, but I don't see that in the record.
Well, the district court found that we showed the first two elements, that Ernetoff was aware the loan would be used to pay the debt and that there was a direct flow from Ernetoff to AdBox to Metcalf. They said that the district court...
The numbers were not the same, though, were they? The numbers that went in different places, they were used for other things. The money was not all paid to your client. They were used. Some of the money that was paid in was used to pay other obligations.
I don't know if there's any evidence about that. I don't know. We haven't submitted any evidence in that regard. We submitted evidence that the $18,000 that went into the account was taken out of the account, and in fact, Mr. Werndahl's wife testified to that, that the $18,000 was used to pay the Metcalf obligation. And the district court found that the motive for Accenta to enable Adbox to pay, the evidence on that issue was weaker than on the other two issues establishing an agreement. And we submit at the summary judgment stage the district court erred in balancing the evidence instead of just considering if there was any evidence in support of that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Goldberg.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Goldberg of the Law Offices of Thomas H. Casey, representing Jeff Golden, who is the trustee in this matter. I'm sorry for my voice this morning. I've had a cold. with regards to the summary judgment order, there was no facts in dispute. And it was only for the purposes of this particular summary judgment motion that the trustee accepted that the other monies deposited by Accenta, or allegedly deposited by Accenta in the amount of $19,500, was actually deposited. Accenta does not agree with that. The district court talked about the two different deposits, but I just wanted to make sure that you understood that Accenta disputes that there was any money deposited by them on June 26, 2002 into the debtor's account. So that is just for the purposes of this motion. We agreed to allow that issue just to go by the wayside. But it does show that there really wasn't any agreement. also, at the bankruptcy court level, we were dealing with the standards that are under the the lead.
Want some water?
No, I'm fine.
Sure.
The Kemp and the Superior stamp and coin cases, and we were arguing about control and whether Accenta and Robin Whitburn, who was the wife of the principal of the debtor, had any control over the funds that they deposited into the debtor's account. And they specifically filed declarations, testimony under oath, that they had no control, that there was no agreement, and there was absolutely no basis for the earmarking defense. But even stepping back before that, there's the aspect of whether they waived the earmark defense. Whether this is a defense or a principle is something that is of issue. Under the Lee case, the earmarking doctrine is considered a court-made defense to a preference action. And pursuant to Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 8A and C, all affirmative defenses must be asserted in the answer or are they deemed waived.
Do you have any authority, Ms. Golden, that at least in this circuit, that earmarking is an affirmative defense and therefore not waived, or rather waived if not pled in the answer?
In the Henry Lee case, 179 BR 149, it's a Ninth Circuit BAP case.
Okay.
And so it's the district court chose not to follow that case because it held it that it was not bound by the BAP case, but the bankruptcy court was bound by the BAP case. But we kind of all skipped right past and went on to the fact there was no facts in support of the earmarking defense, and we really didn't go through the initial element that he waived it. He didn't file it in the answer. There was nothing with regards to that. We also had discussions about the burdens of proof in the earmarking defense, whether it is initially the burden of proof of the trustee to prove that it was property of the debtor, or whether it's the burden of proof of the other side to show that it was not, that it was earmarked funds. And the bankruptcy court went through one analysis while the district court went with another. However, both instances, since the money flowed through the debtor's account, there was a presumption that it was the debtor's property. So we have really no concern that the required elements of the earmarking defense, regardless of who had the burden of proof, initial burden of proof, or who, what presumptions exist, it has both the trustees been successful in allocating that there was no earmarking defense. What wasn't discussed by Mr. Shalvoy was the order dismissing the counterclaim. In response to the trustee's preference complaint, the Metcalfs filed a counterclaim against the trustee for tortious interference with prospective economic advantage, violation of the Civil Code Section 3439, and conspiracy. In this, he alleged that the debtor's assets, the trustee's sale of the debtor's assets was
the
part
only
of...
The real question there is whether the district court got it right that the trustee in his trustee capacity wasn't the right party to sue, right?
I'm not at all questioning that. My only point is that as a counsel for trustees on a regular basis, it not be lost on this court that really that complaint should have gone through the claims process instead of having a complaint against the trustee in his representative capacity as the debtor, representing the debtor.
How do you file a claim that would have brought up these issues?
You just file the claim. And you file it as a complaint. You say this is the amount owed. You can take the claims form and put the number right there and attach your allegations. It is deemed allowed until is it objected to. And by going through the claims process that way, you're allowing a trustee to use his business sense in determining whether it's worthwhile for this bankruptcy estate to object to that claim or not. It could be just deemed allowed and say that's it. By having a creditor...
The claim can, in effect, be a lawsuit?
Yes, it may.
Unliquidated.
Unliquidated. Okay. And it is deemed allowed until objected to. In this instance, this complaint was filed after the claims bar date. So that's another issue, is that when you have the claims process, you have a very short time period in which to file a claim. And so the trustee has an opportunity to find out what are the claims against this bankruptcy estate. And things aren't dragged out and, you know, you don't have these to wait for these long statute of limitations on different causes of actions to run. The trustee can administer the case immediately. But also you leave it up to the trustee to determine whether it is even worthwhile to object to this claim or not. In this instance, given that there was not very many assets in this bankruptcy case, that there probably wouldn't be a distribution to unsecured creditors, the trustee wouldn't have even spent the attorney's fees to object to this claim.
Let me ask you a question. I know that secured creditors have priority over unsecured creditors.
Yes.
What about a creditor with a judgment? Does that have any special weight or not?
No. It's just a liquidated claim. And, you know, a phone bill and a judgment have the same value.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Let's hear the next one, which will require new counsel.